Good afternoon. Tuesday, December the 4th, 2018, 17 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears with you through the next 2 hours. Now, coming up next hour, we've got a great guest. Shecky Green, legendary comedian Shecky Green, will be on to discuss all of the controversy lately with a Cleveland radio station banning the song Baby It's Cold Outside, and also all the talk recently of Santa in the special that we see every year on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer being a bully. So we'll have legendary comedian Shecky Green's very unique take on those two items coming up next hour. You won't want to miss that. Now, this hour we have one of my favorite guests on. It's always a pleasure when she comes on the program, and we have had 2 weeks of a lot of information. We have had Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, losing his plea argument. We have had Michael Cohen giving us information we did not know before about the Russian dealings with the Trump Organization. We have sentencing guidelines that are going to come down this week from Mueller's office on Cohen and Manafort and General Flynn. Plus, we've had the passing of the 41st President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. So a lot to talk about. No better person to talk about it with than, like I say, one of my favorite people. She is a reporter for the Daily Beast. You probably remember and still remember her as a panelist on the long-running television series The McLaughlin Group. Always a pleasure to welcome to these microphones Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing well. Glad to be with you as always, Scott.
Eleanor, I want to start with President Bush. Passed away Friday at the age of 94. You were in the mix of things when President Bush was president. What do you make of his presidency?
Well, he was in some ways a third term of Ronald Reagan, and he was overshadowed by Reagan during his 8 years as vice president in the Reagan administration. And then he sought to differentiate himself from Reagan, and in his inaugural address, he kind of described himself as a kinder, gentler, he didn't say Reagan, but Nancy Reagan, who was there, apparently said kinder, gentler than whom. But that made me kind of look back at the campaign that Bush had run. He'd run a really brutal campaign against Democrat Michael Dukakis, and it was an infamous, it was called the Willie Horton ad, that showed a dark figure, kind of a shadowy figure, going to a revolving door, and he accused Dukakis of being soft on crime. And it was, for the time, it was really overtly racist and really shocking. But, you know, it did the job. President Bush won. And he rather famously kind of separated politics from governing. And so when the campaign was over, that was politics. And politics is kind of a dirty business, and you do what you have to do to win. But as president, he really stepped up to the challenges before him. I do think he was the perfect president for the time, with the Cold War coming to an end and the collapse of the Berlin Wall. He understood that America shouldn't be taking a victory lap, that he didn't want to make it harder than it already was for Gorbachev, who was leading the new Russia and the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he didn't really take any public credit for the New World Order that he helped usher in. He then, in prosecuting the first Gulf War, he put together an international coalition that really did include everybody. And he even, I believe, got the Saudis to pay for much of the war, unlike President Trump, who can't get Mexico to pay for the wall. Anyway, no president since has put together an international coalition of that magnitude, and one that was willing to foot part of the bill. So I think he really handled himself very well on the international stage. A recession kind of took hold while he was in office, and he was a patrician. He was a New England prep school kid who, you know, played squash and kind of pretended he liked pork rinds to make him seem like he was one of the guys. But there was an elitism about him from that sort of old WASP school that rubbed a lot of people in the Republican Party the wrong way. And so he met some challenges within the party from the rising, what would become the Gingrich, Newt Gingrich wing of the party. And so on domestic issues, his big mistake that was actually a huge virtue was that he went back on his promise for no new taxes and actually raised taxes, which led to his successor's ability to actually balance the budget in the 1990s, which now seems kind of unthinkable. So he was a man who showed personal courage as the youngest naval aviator in World War II, and he showed professional courage as a politician too when he met challenges that he had campaigned with opposite ideas and then kind of was able to recognize reality and do what I believe was the right thing for the country. So his style of leadership is also, I think, something that we especially miss right now because he was so respectful of the presidency and the office he held, and we're kind of at a different age now.
He is the only one-term president since Jimmy Carter, and it's kind of interesting because he's also the only one-term president, Republican president, I think since, Harding? Long ways back.
Yeah, and being a one-term president is kind of the definition of failure. You know, to get reelected is what at least puts you in the tier of successful presidents. But as we hear all of the encomiums paid to him this week, I think people are realizing that he did a lot of good in his four short years, and his loss to Bill Clinton was in large part more stylistic. The fact that Bush really couldn't relate to the average Joe, and Clinton very famously could. And then the fact that the two of them became friends, I think Bill Clinton has been there to see him just in recent weeks, and Bill Clinton released the text of a letter that George H.W. Bush had left for him after the presidential contest in 1992, wishing him well and just being, so generous. You're our president now. That ability to set aside the partisan grudges and then do what's best for the country, I think, is like it's like this healing balm that where the country is now experiencing in these days around his passing.
You know, it's interesting, Eleanor. Yesterday on the show, we had CNN historian Douglas Brinkley on. And we were talking about President Bush, and in his first 3 years, he had a very popular first lady, Barbara Bush. The Gulf War was very popular, how he handled it. The Berlin Wall came down. The Soviet Union came apart under President Bush. And then we get to 1992. The election year, and yes, the economy does go into a small recession, but there's also Ross Perot, and who got 19% of the vote. If there had not been Ross Perot, do you think Bush would have gotten a second term?
I know the Bush people and his allies, supporters, believe that if Perot was not in the race, that he would have won. But scholars who've gone state by state point out that Perot didn't actually swing any state. He didn't, I guess he won 19% of the vote, but I don't believe he carried any states. And in exit polls, people who voted for him sort of broke down equally between Bush and Clinton. So I think that belief has been challenged by evidence. But nonetheless, I do think that Bush feels that the whole phenomenon of Perot in the race damaged him, even if the numbers don't bear it out. And, you know, Bill Clinton then was elected with just 43% of the vote, so he came to Washington kind of handicapped also by the fact that Perot had been in the race, and Clinton kind of adjusted his agenda as president and immediately sought deficit reduction because that had been Perot's big issue. And so Perot had an enormous influence on the campaign and how Clinton would actually begin his presidency, paying obedience actually to the issue that Perot had put center stage. And I think Bush really felt that Perot personally had it in for him, and you know, Perot kind of, you know, proved that by pulling out of the race and claiming that the Bush people had tried to interfere in his daughter's wedding. It was really kind of nonsensical. And then he came back in the race. Now, if he hadn't pulled out and then come back in and showed this kind of erratic behavior, he conceivably could have won that year. I mean, I think that really damaged his standing with the American people.
Well, it was kind of interesting. I remember Ross Perot, when he got out of the election, when he was leading the polls at one point, when he got out and people thought he was getting out, in the speech he said, "The Democratic Party has its act back together." And I thought that was an interesting thing to say, because was he there to make sure the Republicans didn't get reelected? I never understood what that remark was all about.
Yeah, and Perot was a Texan, and Texas was one of the states that Bush claimed as his home. He also claimed Connecticut, and maybe there was one other, I can't remember. But, I think there was bad blood between Perot and Bush, definitely.
One of the interesting things about H.W. Bush, and I think I'm right about this, is that we think of Reagan as being a very popular president, Obama as being a very popular president. Certainly W. Bush after 9/11 was very popular. Bill Clinton, a popular president. But I believe in all of those years, from 1980 until present, the highest popularity rating at any one time that any president had was H.W. Bush at 90% after the Gulf War, the Clean Air Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, Berlin Wall coming down, end of the Soviet Union. Was it really just the economy that sunk him?
I think it was. It was the economy and his attitude, I think. A lot of Democrats, big-name Democrats, decided not to run that cycle, and Bill Clinton got into the race. He was governor of Arkansas, and I think he viewed it initially as a letting the country get to know him. I don't think he actually thought that he would win, because when he got in, Bush was way up in the polls and looked like he was he was not going to be defeated. And then the economy took a turn, and it was the sense that Bush didn't really realize how people were hurting, and that was driven home by two events. One was when Bush visited a supermarket, and apparently it was a super-duper new scanner. But, you know, people had been watching items being scanned in supermarkets for years, and Bush acted as though this was some amazing technology that had just arrived on the scene. And, again, it made him look out of touch. And in fairness, I think it was a new kind of technology, but that didn't help him. And then in one of the debates, it might have been the last debate, which was a town hall, and it was the three of them. It was Perot, Bush, and Clinton. And a woman asked, "What is the impact of the deficit on your life?" or something. It was an oddly phrased question, and President Bush didn't seem to kind of grasp what she was getting at. And he gave a kind of a discursive answer, kind of an in-the-weeds answer, and candidate Clinton, took a few steps toward the questioner, you know, made eye contact, and transferred the question around to how a personal question about how this economy and the economic woes were affecting real people in their lives. It was a manifestation of his ability, as the phrase always put it, to feel your pain. And while he was talking with this woman and clearly engaging her in the audience, a camera shot caught President Bush glancing at his watch, you know, kind of wishing it was all over. And that was a moment that really killed him. It was a very bad moment. And in truth, the economy had started to recover before the election, but when President Bush talked about it recovering, it sounded like he was, you know, making excuses. It wasn't taken seriously. And then he also went out encouraging consumer purchases, and he went out, and I think he famously bought a pair of socks or something like that. It was all sort of awkward and didn't really get to the heart of the problem. He didn't really relate to people, and Clinton was very good at that. And the Bush people could not believe that he would be losing to this young guy from a kind of tiny state who had, you know, tried to get out of going to Vietnam. And, you know, Bush was this war hero, genuine war hero. At 18, he had enlisted in the Navy, and he had, you know, been, his plane had been shot down. He'd been rescued from the waters, and he knew what, you know, combat was like and had lived a very honorable life. He'd held all of these jobs. He'd been envoy to China. He'd been ambassador to the United Nations. He'd been Republican National Committee chairman. He'd been CIA director. He'd done everything, and here's this, you know, guy that comes from Arkansas. And so there was a kind of a sense in the Bush campaign that this, they couldn't believe this was really happening to them. And that, of course, just reinforced that elitist entitlement thing that, you know, is deadly in a candidate.
One of the things that I have noticed about the coverage of President Bush in the last few days is this, and I had never really thought about this, but if you go back to 1980, he touched a lot of the presidential politics. He only had his one term as president, but he was Reagan's vice president for two terms. His son was president for two terms. And is there a case to be made as far as doing the job? Because, again, talking with Douglas Brinkley yesterday, his son does, even though his son was a two-term president, he ranks worse on the presidential list than his father. Reagan does rank better, but Reagan tended to delegate a lot of the stuff he did. Reagan had Iran-Contra. The Soviet Union did not end on Reagan's watch. George W. Bush had the Iraq War, which was not a winnable war. The Katrina, not responding quickly. The crash of the economy. Bush seemed to, the economy did go into a small recession, but he did get a lot of things accomplished. Was he, in your opinion, the most functional president of that bunch?
Which bunch are we talking about now?
Reagan, W. Bush, and himself, the three that he touched.
Well, they each brought different strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, Reagan was a transformative personality and a transformative president. I mean, he didn't always transform things in a way that I liked, but he shifted his party towards the right, and towards sort of movement conservatism, and he really was a break from George H.W. Bush. They had run against each other in 1980, and then I think you could say it was a stroke of brilliance on Reagan's part, or whoever was advising Reagan, to pick Bush as the vice president and to have James Baker, his campaign manager, then be the chief of staff in the Reagan White House. That was a bringing together of two, you know, wings of the party in a way that was very, very good for the country. Reagan's two terms, you can chart the beginning of the collapse of the Soviet Union under Reagan. Maybe it fully happened under Bush, but I think Reagan deserves a lot of credit there. And I think, you know, Bush did, he was a very competent foreign policy president in his 4 years, and he kind of blew it domestically. And the son, in attempting, I think, to finish what the father started by going into Iraq, really made a huge strategic error in the Middle East that we continue to pay for and will continue to pay for. So it's very easy for me to put George W. at the bottom of those three, and I think Reagan fairly is number one with the first Bush in the middle. And when the war in Iraq began to go so disastrously bad, there was a lot of kind of, you know, conversation in Washington that the son was really helping remake the father's image, because in contrast, the father looked so much better than the son, because he knew enough not to go plunging into Baghdad. And Bush the elder did tell one of Bush's biographers that he kind of blamed Dick Cheney, the vice president, to George W. He called him, he said he's a real iron ass, and that he had gone so far to the right and become so uncompromising on foreign policy and he had been Bush the senior's defense secretary, so they had once been very close. So I think the father tried to excuse the son, the sins of the son, by saying he'd been led astray by, in fact, the pillars of the war council that served the first President Bush, if you put Donald Rumsfeld in that collection too. And by the second term of W, he had figured out that Cheney and Rumsfeld didn't always have his best interests, and he fired Rumsfeld after the midterm elections in 06, and he and Cheney really never recovered the closeness of their relationship. And Cheney was furious at Bush for refusing to pardon Scooter Libby, who'd been implicated in the Valerie Plame affair, the unveiling of a CIA operative's name, and he had lied to Congress and to the FBI about it. He just got a minimal sentence, which I think 6 months, and Bush commuted the sentence, but he did not pardon him. And Cheney is, I think, furious about that to this day.
It is interesting that it has only happened twice in presidential history that a father and a son both become president. There is this interesting thing, which you just highlighted, Eleanor, that Bush Sr. was in good health, he was competent, he was a former president, he was around. We now know from the Reagan diaries that he had a lot to do with the Reagan presidency, that when he was vice president, they met, they talked. There was even a time, and maybe there still is, that Bush knew something about Iran-Contra. Certainly Dan Rather thought he did. That came out at the end of the 92 campaign, I remember, the weekend of before the election. But there was always this strict thing on both men's part that W. Bush did not consult his father. In the thing you just, the book, that George H.W. Bush helped collaborate with, he didn't like what Dick Cheney was doing. He thought his son had a swagger, kind of a cowboy swagger, and that he shouldn't be doing that. Why do you think there was no consult there? It just didn't seem like, but they both say there wasn't.
Yeah, well, I think that the first Bush felt like the son had to find his own way and make his own mistakes, and so far they couldn't be dictating it. And however much the son loves the father, and I'm sure he's going to have a very difficult time getting through the eulogy tomorrow in the church, that W was always, he was the black sheep of the family. He wasn't the one who was even supposed to be president. It was supposed to be Jeb. And then, in an accident of timing, Jeb lost his first bid to be California governor, and W won in Texas, and then W got reelected. And so it was, he was the one now who was positioned to run for president. And I don't think that he easily took advice from the father, but he did surround himself with all his father's people. I mean, putting Dick Cheney in as his vice president in a rather bizarre episode where Cheney was put in charge of the presidential search committee, and he interviews a number of people and has them fill out questionnaires and everything, and in the end finds that he's the best candidate. and then bringing in Rumsfeld, who had served the father as well, and Colin Powell also, who had served the father. And I think the country found that reassuring because these people had served ably under the first Bush, and it was thought that they would be kind of the grown-ups in the car, and that George W. wouldn't get the keys to the car quite so quickly. I mean, because he did have that reckless air about him, the cowboy swagger. And so having these seasoned people around him who'd all been through the first Bush administration was very reassuring. And then 9/11 happens, and Cheney gets it in his head that if there's even a 1% possibility that Iraq might have weapons of nuclear destruction, that had to be confronted. Now, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. So they were kind of looking for a way to complete the job that they began under the first Bush. And so there was this sense that the first Bush didn't go far enough, that he had an opportunity, that he could have dislodged Saddam Hussein. And so they planned this invasion with shock and awe, and it goes well for like a couple of weeks, but it didn't take long before people began to realize that this was going to be a quagmire and that an insurgency had been set in motion, and that, you know, thousands of people died on the U.S. side and certainly on the Iraqi side, and it was a full-blown disaster by the time W. was running for re-election. And there were many people asked, you know, what does George H.W. Bush think? What does Brent Scowcroft think? He was the National Security Advisor. And what does James Baker think? They were all so fiercely loyal to, you know, both Bushes, really. But whisperings would come out that, you know, Baker and Scowcroft didn't think that much of how the son was conducting the war operations, but they were not brought in and consulted either. So, you know, Bush had his new team that was the old team, but they had kind of done a 180 on how to respond in the Middle East. And I think it was Colin Powell, of course, who was kind of the odd man out. He was he even said to himself that he felt like he's the refrigerator, that they only bring him out when needed or something. But he made that famous speech before the United Nations, which they basically signed off on the Bush war policy, and he later, I mean, I think he has actually apologized that he felt like he was misled, and he made a case for war that really didn't exist.
It's kind of interesting because I think CNN did a couple specials, very good specials, on George H.W. Bush on Saturday night. And during one of those specials, George W. Bush was asked about this quote from his father, about that he had this cowboy swagger and that they don't consult each other and that he wouldn't have done things that way. And George W. Bush's answer was, I have my daddy's eyes and my mother's mouth. that was kind of the response to it. And it is interesting how the 8 years of Bill Clinton, which is what separated the two, were fascinating, because when Gerry Ford died, who Bush had worked under in the CIA role, that Gerry Ford wanted this tape released, but only after his death, at how opposed to the Iraq War and W. Bush he was. So was George W. H.W. Bush the end of a certain kind of Republican?
Yeah, that kind of Republican. I mean, he actually walked away from parts of that Republican Party too. That was the Rockefeller wing that was so dominant in the Northeast. And I guess H.W. Bush, by leaving Connecticut and going to Texas and trying to forge a business, and not trying to, he forged a business career as an oil man, was his way of saying that Northeast Connecticut Yankee Republican was not the direction the party was going, because he tried to take on the attributes of the more wildcatting Republican party. And I just always remember him claiming he loved pork rinds. I mean, maybe he did, but that was not the image of the Northeast Republican. And if you look at the Republican Party now, they have so few people in the Northeast that you can count them on the fingers of one hand. Now, the Democrats have their problems, too. They have some of the opposite problems. But moderate Republican is gone. And in some ways, Bush had no alternative than to be the moderate Republican, because he had a Democratic Congress the whole time he was in office. And when he was in office, Democrats had held the House majority for like 40 years, and nobody could imagine that it would ever be any different. Now, that in 94, the Gingrich-led revolution turned the House Republican, but that was after Bush had left office. And so you mentioned earlier in the show the Clean Air Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. I mean, these are all pieces of legislation that the Democrats wanted, and that there weren't enough Republicans to oppose. But Bush had 40 vetoes during his presidency. He vetoed a Civil Rights Act in 1991. There's huge backlash to that. I think there was only one piece of legislation that the Congress was able to overturn. So he kept the Republican Party together then, in opposition to what the Democrats were doing. But the pieces of legislation he did get through were all things that the Democrats wanted, and that he agreed with the common ground and found the common ground, and I commend him for that. And of course, his reversing his pledge on the no new taxes is what really, really probably ended his chances for re-election, because that really set the Republican Party at odds with each other, and the Gingrich wing and the rising conservatives really, really took off.
As we have said, George H.W. Bush is the only one-term Republican president since Hoover. Hoover was the last Republican president before him not to be reelected, and everyone has been reelected since H.W. Bush. But the 92 election, he did lose, and it was a nasty campaign, nastier, I think, than most had been in a long time. It was the first cable news campaign. And then there comes a friendship between Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. Was that, from your gathering, a real friendship?
I remember in the campaign, Bush called Al Gore Ozone Man, and he called Bill Clinton Bozo. And he said they got their foreign policy from the House of Pancakes or something like that. It was kind of juvenile language. And so it was a hard-fought campaign, but I don't think there was any rhetoric exchange there that would leave lasting scars. It wasn't like the Willie Horton business. And I think, Clinton and Bush, the senior Bush, came together initially over hurricane relief for Haiti, I think it was. And it was the son who asked the two of them to join together to raise money. And that, now let's give the son some credit here to put the two of them together. And Bill Clinton is charming, and he really revered Bush. Now, he beat him, but he revered him for all of that expertise he had, for the military prowess. And so I think it was a genuine relationship. And they spent time together, you know, that was not publicized. And I think Barbara Bush was a little skeptical, but she said that she thought that Bill Clinton regarded her husband as the father he never had. And the senior Bush kind of got a kick out of Bill Clinton and would often say, "Now I can see why he beat me." And there was one anecdote that Jonathan Alter told on television the other day. He said they had toured some historical site, I think it was in Haiti, when they were there. And Clinton had asked the tour guide, "Well, who painted this painting on the wall?" And he was told. And then later in the tour, Clinton was talking to someone else and said to someone else, "That's my favorite painter." And, you know, he'd never heard of him until like 30 minutes earlier. And George H.W. Bush said, "Now I knew why the guy beat me." So, I mean, that he could personalize anything and make it understandable and relatable to people. And so I think they each admired each other in their own way. And Bill Clinton sent him socks, I think, with the Clinton Foundation insignia or Clinton Library or something. And when they were together, I think just a few weeks ago, Bush was pictured wearing those socks. He had a thing about wearing particular socks to commemorate occasions, and apparently he's being laid to rest in some military socks. So, yeah, I do think that was a genuine relationship, and ex-presidents are this very unique little club, and there was a very good book written about that by two Time magazine correspondents a few years ago about the friendship among former presidents. And I think Jimmy Carter's always been a little bit of an odd man out.
Is he coming to the funeral? We were talking about that this morning. He's not mentioned in any of the literature.
Huh. I don't know about that.
Odd man out again.
He would not have any. There's no reason why he wouldn't, except he is 94 himself, and could be that he's, but he seems to be still continuing a pretty rigorous schedule. I was wondering, is Dan Quayle there? I haven't seen him at all. He was Bush's vice president, and of course, he took a lot of mocking and jokes about him during his 4 years. I don't think it was a very pleasant experience that he had. And there was a lot of talk that Bush wanted to replace him with someone else when he was running for re-election. And in the end, the famous Bush loyalty held, and so Quayle was there for the re-elect. But I haven't heard him cited. I haven't heard him giving any of his reminiscences. And so you kind of wonder, when somebody isn't there, are they okay? Where are they?
Well,
yeah.
We were talking this morning, and the last funeral for all president we had was Gerry Ford back in 2006, and Nancy Reagan was not listed in any of the literature as attending, and Tom Brokaw, one of the eulogists, got up and gave the eulogy, and he recognized all the former presidents who were there and didn't recognize her, and she was there behind a pole. So I don't know, maybe Jimmy Carter will be, but he does seem to be the odd man out. Hard to tell.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although his post-presidency has been very significant, and I think his one term also will be reevaluated in a much more positive way than it has been.
Now, somebody who will be at the funeral tomorrow in Washington and was asked to be by George H.W. Bush, President Trump. The first one of these high profile. He was not asked to Barbara Bush's funeral, not asked to John McCain's funeral. And Douglas Brinkley yesterday told us a story that he said hadn't been recounted, that in 1988, when Bush ran for president the first time, Donald Trump was lobbying to be his vice president.
And, oh, my.
And Bush did not like him. Thought he was braggadocious and grandiose and couldn't stand him. And yet, he wanted him to be there. When all, even his own wife, left word not to have him come.
At her.
Yeah. Yeah. Bush.
Well, but he's not speaking. He's not delivering
a
eulogy.
He's not speaking. That's true. But he's got. Yeah. Do you think he'll run into the Obamas and the Clintons there?
I think he'll be sat. He'll be seated with them. Yes.
Does
I
that,
mean, they're not going to put him in a separate wing.
Well, does that become a story? You know, the cameras will be on. Do they greet him? Do they?
I think everyone will be polite.
That's good.
Yeah.
But does it say something that he is the first one under the Trump presidency 2 years in that says, no, I want him there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the appropriate gesture, and it was also the appropriate gesture when John McCain went the other way. So, and Barbara too. So I think it's got to be each to his own.
When we look back at the Bush presidency, Douglas Brinkley puts it 20s. Where do you rank him? Is he didn't have a, this is interesting, and I wanted to broach this before we wrap it up here, and this has been fun reminiscing. Didn't get to the other news stories. We'll have to do that sometime soon.
Right.
But all the way back to LBJ, really, you had Vietnam, and Nixon had Watergate, Ford had the pardon, Carter had a lousy, lousy economy, Reagan had Iran-Contra, Clinton had impeachment with Monica Lewinsky, W. Bush had the Iraq War and the collapse of the economy. Is Bush in there with Obama as really the only scandalous presidents?
Yeah, and not only that, when you consider all the top jobs he held, and he was untouched by scandal in all of those. Now, he did claim he was out of the loop, and he did cut off the investigations into Iran-Contra after like 7 years. So there might have been stuff that came out. But no, for the most part, the scandal-free should be attached to him, and no ethical conflicts. He was an honorable man.
Other presidents served longer, but in his 4 years, and we've ran him down many times in this program, but did anybody else accomplish that much in 4 years? Domestically, with the Clean Air Act, an oil man to do that, odd.
Yeah. Well, compared, you know, our expectations are now so low because Congress is in this constant gridlock, it's impossible to get anything done. And I think Bill Clinton lamented the fact that he didn't have any, you know, great, huge international crisis. He had issues, obviously, on his watch, but he didn't have the kinds of things that would make you go down in history as a great president. He didn't have those challenges. But in terms of domestic accomplishments, if you even look back at what Jimmy Carter got done, I mean, again, it was a different world. There was a lot of partisan rancor, but it was certainly not like it was today, where the one side doesn't want to give the other side anything.
You know, and it even almost seems as if the Democrats during the Bush years, even more so than the Reagans, even though we hear of Tip O'Neill getting along with Reagan so well, that there were, except for that budget, where Bush had to go back on his no new taxes pledge, there really was not a whole lot of rancor, it seemed. Certainly not like we see today.
Yeah, except the conservatives in the party did not trust Bush. And they were really out to bring down the country club wing of the Republican Party. So it was kind of the enemy within for Bush.
Does he go down as a good president?
Yes, I think that's definitely fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Eleanor, it's always fun to chat with you. And like I say, with these sentencing guidelines coming down this week, there'll be a lot more to talk about. So I hope we can talk again very soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back in about 10 minutes with Shecky Green. Don't go anywhere.